I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, it's Midday on Education with Dr. Sonia Santelises, the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. Slightly more students are graduating from city high schools than in years past, and fewer are dropping out. But the gap in academic performance between white students and students of color persists. A recent audit showed that although about 44% of city students take at least some career and technical education courses, very few are being placed in the kinds of jobs that provide a family-sustaining wage. The ACLU and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund are suing the State Board of Education for inadequate funding of city schools. This as the first round of money recommended by the Kerwin Commission is released. Dr. Sonia Santelises joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. As another school year comes to a close, we thought it a good time to check in again with Baltimore City Public Schools CEO, Dr. Sonia Santelises, who joins me here in Studio A for the hour. The high school graduation rate is up for city kids and the dropout rate is down. But the achievement gap between white students and students of color persists, and the system still faces challenges associated with dropping enrollment and aging infrastructure. You can join our conversation with Dr. Santelises on the WIPR Facebook page, where we are streaming live, and a little bit later in the program, we will take your calls and comments. It's good to see you. Welcome
back.
Great
to be here.
And it's interesting, you know, just as a general rule, my general impression is that this year has been a little bit less dramatic than the last couple of years that preceded it. Is that your impression too?
Oh, without a doubt. And when we have spent, you know, the team, and I include principals in schools, I got a couple of calls last week. People feel like we actually had a year where we could double down, focus in on the most important work, and we're seeing some of the movement, which is really exciting.
Yeah, let's talk about graduation rates. They are up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, how much are they up?
Mm-hmm.
And are you measuring them the same way? In other words, is this apples and apples to how we've done before? Because so many times when these statistics come out, you just never know whether they're comparing something that's really similar to what happened in prior years.
No, and it's a great question, Tom. I think one of the things that we do know is this year, so over about an 8 to 9 year trajectory, we've had just over a 10% gain in graduation rates, which is good news for the city. It's good news for our young people. We had the largest single year of growth in graduation rates. We know that young people who graduate wherever they live, whatever city, have far greater likelihood of being able to sustain, you know, a family with that. And so that's good news. Where we still have work to do, and this is why we don't use just one single data point, is really making sure that our young people are prepared when they leave. So we know that they're already they have a leg up if they're graduating. But one of our real areas of focus is making sure that more young people are prepared either for college or career when they leave. And so we're happy about that. We're pleased. It means that our principals and teachers are really doubling down on making sure kids have what they need to graduate. Now we're really focusing on the quality of the preparation of young people so that they're ready when they leave.
So the other encouraging part of this is that it's up in all the categories. Mm-hmm. African-American kids up for about a point and a half. Hispanic Latino students up from 52 to 54, or almost 55. So they're up about 3 points. White kids up about 3 points as well. So
mm-hmm.
it is the trajectory is right. In terms of preparedness, I mean, not every kid goes to college, obviously, but those kids in that category who are graduating and want to continue in college, are you under the impression that they're going to show up and not going to be required to take all sorts of remedial classes? Are they really ready to go on to the, you know, the 13th grade, as it were?
Yeah, and not as many as we want to be. And it's part of why we spent the last really 2 years really looking at first, what does our foundational curriculum look like? And we knew that it wasn't rigorous enough. And so what we're hearing from teachers, what we're hearing from young people and even parents is that early shift in our curriculum and what kids are being exposed to means that from an earlier age, we have more runway to get young people ready. And so we're starting to see some really promising early results from those shifts. You know, they're the non-sexy thing. You know, you talk to everyday folks in the grocery store about curriculum and they kind of are like, oh, okay. But what we've seen, what our teachers are telling us is that when young people are doing more writing, more rigorous reading earlier, when we are focusing on, you know, more advanced math over a longer period of time, they're beginning to see students coming in with greater levels of preparation. That means, though, in the interim, we still have to address that gap that you referenced in terms of acceleration. So we've been doing some real deep looking now, and even with some of our community partners around what do we do to help accelerate young people who might be further along, closer to graduation. As you know, that was part of the findings of the CTE report that we commissioned. And so one of the things that we are saying, and I think it's important for our community here in Baltimore to know, is it's not a choice of college or career anymore. No one is making a family-sustaining wage by just going and offering to dig holes, right? Like, that's not happening. What we are focused on and what we know is that some of those high-level reading and writing skills, high-level math skills, are required even for young people who aren't going to go to four-year college immediately, but are going into programs post-secondary to train to be in fields like HVAC. You can't just walk off the street and not know math or know how to read and expect to get a career in HVAC. So part of what's actually promising, I think, is us really digging down deeply. And I'm actually excited. I think a lot of the work that we've put the groundwork in is going to show.
Dr. Sonja Sonalesis is my guest. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We are streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. A little bit later, we'll take some calls and comments. We'll talk about CTE in just a second. That's career and technical education. You commissioned a report that actually showed some bad news. Mm-hmm. But let's go back to some good news. And that is coincident with the or coinciding with the graduation rates. You also have fewer kids dropping out.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
both of these instances, this is good news that's attributable to what? Is it just curriculum? Is it mainly curriculum or what else is going on that's working?
No, and I think we said in our blueprint, when we laid out the blueprint, now we're completing the second year of our strategic plan of the blueprint. Part of why it was not just a focus on curriculum, it was also a focus, frankly, on the social emotional needs of young people. And so I think that reduction in dropouts and increases in graduation is also a signal that we have more schools focusing on how do we build quality relationships between adults and young people. That frankly lead to young people wanting to stay and being less likely to leave. And in schools where we have dug very deeply into that, we're hearing and seeing some of those changes. Not overnight, but I was at a school last week, one of what we call our intensive learning sites, that a school that went really deeply in social emotional learning. And this, they've only been doing it for a year. And there was a panel of students that we got a chance to hear from. And they still talked about some challenges, but overall, Tom, what the young people were saying is it just feels better to be in school.
Like, so social emotional learning, does that mean you've got more staff psychologists on the scene? I mean, what does that mean?
Great question. So a lot of what that means is we're actually training teachers how to use particular strategies and techniques within the classroom. I got to observe young people in just 15 minutes of circle time, right? And not just circles for circles, but circles designed to have young people share where they're coming from. We had young people who were sharing, in some cases, some painful experiences. But when I got a chance to talk to them after and say, well, why would you share that at school? And they said, because I feel comfortable. We've been working on this all year, and I feel like this is a place I can share. And so a lot of our young people, when they have these spaces where they have adults who have additional tools, and our teacher said to us, we need additional tools, they're able.
So they did professional development in this particular
area.
They
did professional development. We also did investments in what we were calling our wellness rooms. So these are rooms in classrooms. We gave those schools extra funding to have a space that's staffed by a trained professional to help with things like mediation, with de-escalation, kids coming in with really challenges from home or neighborhood. neighborhood have a place they can go to in the school where they get some one-on-one, real kind of coaching and hand-holding through that, and frankly, learn tools to how to de-escalate themselves, right? And different approaches to problem solving. And in those schools, what we're seeing is students actually taking ownership themselves of, I think I need to go. Right. I'm feeling like I'm going to explode. I feel like I've got a lot of pressure, and they have a place to go where they can spend a little bit of time with someone they know. We have, you know, mindfulness centers in some of the rooms. But what teachers are telling us is when young people have those spaces, in addition to the tools they're using, they're seeing less confrontation between young people. They're seeing less violent outbursts. They're seeing less instances of young people just, you know, not knowing how to process and being having emotional blocks to learning. It doesn't take the place of, you know, the need for psychologists. We're really pleased that this year we prioritized in our budget, so every school will have a full-time social worker. We did that. We increased the number of arts teachers coming this school year, because we also know that places, you know, arts is an experience for a lot of young people that helps them also kind of de-escalate, express themselves, find other ways, other outlets for letting go of some of, frankly, some real heavy stuff that a lot of young people are dealing with.
You know, I was thinking, I took a run this morning down by the Inner Harbor, this beautiful part of town. The sun had just come up. I'm a regular down there. There's a bunch of people down there who are regulars at that hour of the morning. And my mind drifted to when I was in high school, a long, long time ago, in the 1970s, I went to a little school in suburban Boston, Dover, Massachusetts.
I know where Dover is.
It's the same school that Marilyn Mosby graduated from many years
That's
later.
Great.
The Dover-Sherburn Regional High School. Our towns were so small that we had to have two towns together, and the school had probably fewer than 1,000 kids. And in my sophomore year, three of my classmates, or people from the school that I knew, died. One was killed in Vietnam. Another was killed in a drunk driving accident, and a third was killed when he got out of the car in a freak accident, and the car moved a little bit, and he fell down and hit his head, and he died instantly. So three kids. Now, we didn't have, like, people coming in, you know, trauma directors coming in and talking to the kids in the school. That they hadn't gotten hip to that yet. But I just remembered in our little town how traumatic it was that these three kids died. You had a ceremony last month in which you acknowledged the 12 students in the Baltimore City public school system who lost their lives just in this last year. One of them 7 years old, the oldest 19 years old. The trauma that attends that, because these are just kids in the schools. It's not to say that it's not the brothers and sisters, the older ones, and the aunts and uncles and moms and dads that many of these children also know, who are losing their lives to gunshot wounds. And, you know, to address that trauma in a school, I mean, it sounds like you're certainly acknowledging that the trauma exists and that the trauma manifests itself in a lot of different ways. But boy, oh boy, how does a school system deal with that, something that, you know, huge and that traumatic?
No, and it is the question that we're asking. I think a lot of credit is due to teachers who themselves, frankly, are experiencing secondary trauma. I mean, I've gone to some of these hospital rooms, and I'm not in the position most teachers are. And there was a point last summer I needed to go and talk to someone. I had been to too many funerals. I had seen too many young bodies of our students, and even I needed a break and someone to decompress with, let alone our teachers, who really, in many cases, are the front line. And they're seeing this. And so I think part of what we've been doing and part of why we made the investment, even with limited dollars, to commit to say we need a full-time social worker in every school. And we're going to do that from a central budget, not the school budget. You know, we're having conversations. I will say our new health commissioner, I've had conversations with her. What's really encouraging is she understands the real severe mental health needs that a lot of our young people are facing because of the very instances. And then in some cases, it needs to be acknowledged. Like, that's what the remembrance ceremony was for us. And I had a number of even our central office staff who said, thank you. We needed some way to process the fact that our city lost 12 young lives due to gun violence. I mean, these weren't young people. We always have young people who are critically ill from illness and disease. These were 12 young people we lost to gun violence. And that needs to be acknowledged in a different way. So we really are trying to work on that. Our Human Capital Office has done more work than my 10 years in Baltimore and really trying to proactively connect our employees to some of those support services, doing more wellness work with our school leaders. We're not nearly where we need to be in terms of how do you create a school environment for the staff. But I think it gets into some of the questions that, you know, we've been asking with our state funding formula. It does. It costs more.
And that's the thing. I mean, I bring this up because one of the ways it does manifest is in the funding formulas, because it's just the city of Baltimore has different needs than Howard County or Anne Arundel County or Charles County or St. Mary's County. And so if the funding is different, it's because the needs are different. And just, you know, folks got to keep that in mind.
That's right. And I always remember going to visit an early learning center in Israel, and it was specifically targeting Ethiopian immigrant children who had come from clearly very violent kind of war-torn situations at places. And Tom, you know, they had full-time pediatric neurologist, full-time art therapist, 2 full-time psychologists, a social worker, right? All on staff for 1 community center, right? For 1. And I thought, my God, like the value that signals to that community about how their children are viewed, as opposed to principals in our system who are scraping together funds just to get a full-time, you know, 1 psychologist, right? And many of them can't. So it is an issue.
Dr. Sonia Sonalisis is with me today here in Studio A. She is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming our conversation. We will be back in exactly 90 seconds. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a special Juneteenth edition of Midday. We're going to be broadcasting live from the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. Our topic is reparations. Can America atone for the sin of slavery? My guests will be Dr. Ray Winbush of Morgan State University, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and Morgan Professor E.R. Shipp, and Ajoa A. Ayatoro. She's one of the founders of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. So if you'd like to join us in the audience at the Lewis, tickets are free, but you do need to register. So come to our website, wypr.org, to get your name on the list. We are looking forward to having Midday live at the Lewis tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, Dr. Sonia Sonalisis is also live here in Studio A. She is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To send us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWYPR. And you can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's talk about this CTE report, which is written about in the Baltimore Sun just today, actually, or yesterday. This is concerns vocational programs, career and technical education. 44% of students, roughly, in the city school system have some contact. Some are sort of full-time CTE kids. But you found that, you know, the kinds of jobs that these kids were able to go to from that training directly from high school just weren't cutting it in terms of wages. You called it a caste system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and part of why I used that reference was because what we found in this study, which again, you know, I will just emphasize, we commissioned this study. We wanted to know the extent to which our programs were actually meeting young people's needs, right? And one of the things that we found, you know, which makes sense, is that for young people who had the greatest proficiency in particular areas, right? If you went to a particular high school, you were more likely to have a program, be engaged in a CTE program, a career program that led to what I like to call family sustaining wages, right? And the scary part when we looked and saw the analysis that our partners at ESG did, and very similar to what the Fund for Educational Excellence did, was we saw that access to those programs was limited in certain high schools, certain sections of the city. And so part of what we are going to be doing, and we've already started, by the way, we didn't wait until the board meeting when things were released, our head of career and tech ed and college and career readiness, Dr. Rachel Pfeiffer, from the onset, she was only on board a couple of months when she commissioned this, because she knew that we needed to take a deeper look. But we are really working now. We've already started. We're going to be coming, sharing the plan, the draft of the plan, with the public, with families, this fall. So I encourage people to look. But the bottom line is, we have different tiers of career options, career study options, that lead either towards that goal of family sustaining wage or much further from that family sustaining wage. So,
and by the way, we should say that it's considered to be a family sustaining wage, a compensation of $28 an hour.
That's right. That's right.
And we look what the Maryland legislature did. They turn themselves into pretzels coming up with a $15 minimum wage thing, and there is no federal statute that requires $15.
That's right. And when you have graduates coming from our high schools, which we found through this, you know, ESG found through this analysis, who are coming out making $13,000 a year, that is not a viable, true career option. And when we take a look at those industries that actually do lead to family sustaining wage, they require what I referenced earlier, and that is solid background in mathematics. No, you don't have to take AP calculus or be a physics whiz, but you know, this myth that you can just go grab a shovel these days and, you know, earn a family sustaining wage is not true. So one of the things we're really proud of already, even when we got some of the preliminary reports, is this coming fall will actually be opening four new programs that are better aligned to industry growth, those kind of higher level wages. And we actually looked across the city. And so we'll be opening them, looking at our community conditions index, where are the programs located. So we're real proud. So we'll have our new HVAC training program at Reach, where young people will be able to leave with HVAC certification. And anybody in the field I talk to is like, if you walk out with HVAC certification, you are starting with a very competitive salary. We'll have a construction program that actually, I'll give a shout out to the Lieutenant Governor for really being supportive of a new construction program at Patterson High School, because again, in that section of the city, there really was not any you know, there wasn't any opportunity unless you went to a high school outside of the community. So we're very excited about the construction program there. And again, it'll be construction that leads to family sustaining wages. We'll have an electrician program and a new plumbing program. So these are all examples of career trajectories that lead to family sustaining wages. And one of the other pieces that's been great about this study, and even since the report came out yesterday, the number of emails I've gotten from industry professionals in Baltimore City who say we want to actually be part of the solution has been really encouraging and really heartening. So we're going to be doing more of that. And like I said, we have a whole different level of outreach to the employer community, because to a point, you know, you were making before we, you know, got back on air, you know, the reality is that, you know, employers are saying, the skills
they
kids
can't
are coming.
Hire anybody.
I can't hire people. And so we are really committed, Dr. Pfeiffer is her team, to really having a closer relationship with those folks pushing down to the middle schools, because one of the other pieces we're finding is that, you know, a lot of these, it's not that it's new news, but a lot of young people who previously might not have had incentive to actually dig deeply into math before, what we found is when we give them real career internship opportunities, when they get to see what the work looks like, the incentive to do deeper reading, deeper mathematics is embedded in those experiences.
Yeah, the age-old question that every high school kid asks, why do I need to know
this?
That's
right.
Yeah,
that's right.
If you're in a job situation, you'll know exactly why you need to know.
Absolutely.
Because the industries that you've identified as the six key fields, advanced manufacturing, mm-hmm. business administration, construction, as well as healthcare, IT, and transportation.
Yes.
So that, you know, the literacy that's required both, you know, linguistically and mathematically mm-hmm. Is high in all of those things.
That's exactly right.
I was also interested that some of the big CTE programs are actually in schools that we associate with high academic performance. I mean, Poly High School, one of the, you know, premier
exactly
schools,
right.
has a very good career and technical education program. But you're not finding them in some of the other neighborhoods and some of the other places where clearly it's needed.
That's exactly right. And that was the caste system I talked about, right? It is, you know, The schools that traditionally, right, have greater concentrations of young people who are performing at or above proficiency are the ones that have the career connections to, frankly, more of the higher, more highly compensated fields. And so that's the work we're doing now is really disrupting that kind of predictable trajectory. And some of it is just making sure we have young people who have more advanced reading, writing, and math skills. And that's where a lot of our work is.
Yeah, Chris sends us a long email that says hundreds of kids every year leave high school who will not transition to college and have no marketable skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the city schools, like many systems, that bought in for a single track of its students, the liberal arts track, you know, a liberal arts classroom only model does not entice students, nor does it provide mm-hmm. for transition to a technical career. So you're saying that, you know, you're hip to this, that you're going to have a panoply of offerings that mm-hmm. Are going to be able to sort of meet the needs of a lot of different kinds of kids.
Yes. And I think the other piece, you know, and while, you know, I agree with Chris, and the spirit of what's being said, I would also say we did have CTE programs that attracted young people. The question is even deeper than just do we have those programs. The question is which programs actually lead to family sustaining wage or above. And so you can have a plethora. I mean, we have them listed. But one of the things Dr. Pfeiffer and her team are now doing is reworking all of that coursework, because not all of those programs, there might be a plethora of them, but those programs are not leading to high wage jobs. So it's that and the step and the fact that, you know, people used to say, well, you don't really need to be good at math to do some of these professions. And that's not true anymore. I mean, high levels of knowledge are required for all young people these days. There's no back door out of that.
Dr. Sonia Sonalisis is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday, 410-662-8780, midday at WYPR.org, our Twitter handle at midday WYPR. You can also ping us on Facebook. Tiffany on Facebook says, can you discuss the three things that a PTO or a PTA can do to be most helpful to the development and progression of a school, specifically in elementary or middle school? Mm. So parent-teacher organizations, parent-teacher associations. What's your recommendation?
So my recommendation, and one, I will just say thank you to Tiffany for that question. I think number one is be aware of making sure that families and parents have access to what the milestones are that young students should be touching along the way. And I think a powerful role for the PTO is to help educators get out of our education-ese and translate that to families. They should know, and they should be able to advocate for their young people because of that. Two, be involved in the budget process at your local school. Be part of the decisions about what are the extracurriculars we want to have available, what are the interests for our young people, making that absolutely knowledgeable. And don't underestimate family gathering activities that actually reinforce academic and social emotional learning. And what we are finding in our schools that have strong parent engagement, and frankly, parents who will advocate for their young people is that they're building community and knowledge by making connections between families. And I think that helps keep us accountable, quite frankly, at both the school and the district level when we have informed parents.
Yeah, community. If it's community of families and schools, you know,
that's
community
right.
just helps. It takes a village,
it
as
sure
we
does.
Are prone to say. Lee is one of your teachers who says, where do you stand on unannounced formal observations for teachers? I'm a teacher in the city, and while I understand the desire for authentic assessment, enacting this will be impossible and open to abuse by vindictive administrators. So the larger issue of recruiting mm-hmm. teachers, which I know is always a challenge, and dealing with a declining enrollment population. But, you know, when it comes to metrics for teachers,
sure.
Do you do a lot of unannounced observations where all of a sudden somebody shows up in a classroom and then writes up a report?
So, and I think what he's really referring to, I think it's he, is it Lee?
It's Lee.
So it could be he or so Lee, whoever. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I think one of the key pieces that we've been having discussions on, and we saw this even in our most recent board meeting, is this idea of, to me, the goal is that every day in every classroom, every student will experience high-level instruction. And so the question that Lee's placed on the table is, should every observation or visit that can count towards a teacher's evaluation be able to be included in that? I have talked to teachers. I had dinner with about 20 first-year teachers who expressed similar concerns as Lee's. But one of the things that was interesting is their concerns dissipated when we discussed what would happen if you were in a school environment where, one, you felt as if you were being supported, where, two, your trajectory of growth was being assessed, not just incidental, one instance. And if you actually felt that you had space to learn while ultimately being held accountable for every student, every day, in every classroom, right, having access to high levels of instruction, their concerns dissipated. I think what Lee is touching on is, how do we prepare administrators to create an environment that's conducive to that kind of exchange? This is not a new idea or a foreign idea. There are many urban systems. There are many other school systems across Maryland that have this provision. But I think at the heart of the question, when I listen to teachers' concerns, is they want it to be grounded in a full, trusting, developmental experience where there's constant feedback and not a fear of I gotcha. And so we've got to work on both ends.
Yeah, a lot of times that distrust can be in that building.
That's
you
right.
Know, if a teacher says, well, this administrator had it out for me, and she's the one doing the observation.
That
could be nerve-wracking. Let's see if we can sneak a call in before we go to the break. To James in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Santelises.
Good morning, Tom. This is Mr. Williams, Education Advocate. How you doing?
Oh, doing great, sir. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, the math component that Dr. Santelises spoke of has to be thought out more, because middle school math, elementary school math are really bad off when it comes to, in particular, middle school math. Our math scores have been abysmal for decades, okay? So we have to face that honesty, Dr. Santelises and Tom, and we have to redo the math curriculum, period. Because I had a grandson that was in second grade math. I couldn't help him with it because the language was foreign to me as a grandparent. So I actually met with someone at North Avenue concerning that, because the math curriculum language is not parent-friendly at all.
So okay, well, that's a good point, James.
We were trying to be involved. We have to understand that the language dynamic of the math curriculum has to change in its, I mean, communication abilities with parents and guardians of students who attend public schools.
All right, good point, James. I appreciate it. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation just published a mm-hmm. report called Kids Count. 67% of eighth graders are not proficient in math. That's mm-hmm. nationally. Mm-hmm. And it's also the percentage in Maryland here. That's down or up from 2009. So in the last 10 years, mm-hmm. we're 7 points worse in terms of proficiency in math in the eighth grade.
Yeah.
Is it a curriculum project, as James mentions? Is it a way that these courses are being taught? So, you know, this poor guy is a guy who's clearly involved and interested in education. Mm-hmm. He says he can't figure out the language in his second second graders' homework.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of pieces here, and I also want to thank James for flagging this. So one, we moved to new math curriculum 2 years ago, and part of why we did that is we saw schools that were implementing that same curriculum were experiencing gains in student math achievement. I think the piece that that James flags that's very important that we are definitely working on, I want to credit our new chief for family and community engagement and communications, Tina Hike Hubbard, is working with the comms team. And one of the things that we are developing now is guides for parents and families on, frankly, what the curriculum projection is in, as James notes, very family-friendly language, so that families know in first grade, these are the major math concepts that your child is going to be learning that you can review with them.
And these will be written in English.
These will be written in English
not
and
in Spanish. Educationalese.
Not in educationese.
But in Spanish so that people can understand.
And in Spanish so that people can understand. And I will tell you, it's been an exercise for a lot of our curriculum folks because, you know, when they're sitting
sure.
with the family and community engagement people and they're like, we don't understand that, take it back. But I will say to James, what we're very excited about is, one, we are seeing some growth. We've increased across the city the offerings for advanced mathematics in middle grades. We're seeing some really great gains there that we're very excited about. And to stay tuned, and it would be wonderful if you would be one of our parent test readers to give us the feedback on whether we are. But the curriculum we're using now, we're seeing some early results, and other districts that have used this curriculum are also seeing results. So we're excited.
We'll have more with Baltimore City Public Schools CEO Dr. Sonia Sonalesis when we come back from a quick break. You're welcome to join us at that point. 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. You can ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. You can follow me on Facebook at Tom Hall, WYPR. You can also tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today it's Midday on Education. And by the way, next week on Tuesday, we will continue our end of school education coverage when we reassemble the panel of teachers we spoke to in the fall before the school year began. Robert Marinelli teaches high school science. Tavon McGee teaches middle school math. And Karen Ginyard teaches elementary school math and reading. So we'll check in with them to see how the year went in their classrooms. If you've just joined us today, Dr. Sonia Sonalesis is my guest. She is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. She, too, joined us last fall, and she's spending the hour with us again today. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Facebook, the WYPR Facebook page. We are streaming our conversation there. You can also drop us a tweet. We got a bunch of calls, Dr. Sonalesis, so let's see if we can get to some of them. Let's go to Eric in Baltimore City. Welcome to the show, sir.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask Dr. Sonalesis about her comment about living wage, about sustaining wages. This is a subject of keen interest to me. I have four children in the Baltimore City school system. I'm an adjunct professor myself. I think we lose sight of something that is fundamental when we talk about education as being for the sake primarily of earning. If you tell kids, I was the first in my family to go to college, there wasn't much money for it. If you tell kids that the reason they should get a STEM education, there's so much emphasis on that, STEM. If you tell them that, that they can get $28 a job that pays them $28 an hour. Why wouldn't they, if they knew they could do something else that's more lucrative, however dubious it might be, like dealing drugs or like becoming a professional athlete, why wouldn't they do that?
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
All we can offer people.
All right, Eric, I appreciate the comment. You know, I guess it's a matter of emphasis.
Yeah.
You know, is it learning for learning's sake, or is it learning to prepare you to have a career and a job? I mean, there's a little bit of both, I guess.
Yeah, no, there is. And I actually don't think it's an either or. What again, because the question was focused on our career technical programs, and that was the analysis we were doing, oftentimes young people are expecting to be able to support themselves. But I completely agree with the caller. It's not just about that. It's about citizenship. It's about finding one's gifts. It's why we're increasing, we made a significant investment in increasing arts teachers. It's why we have a focus with our principals on extracurriculars as well. It is about all of that. I will also say that this came from, these questions were not the school system necessarily asking. They were coming from graduates themselves. I mean, I have talked to young people who are involved in gang activity, and for a lot of them, they will say, if I had some other way of making a living, I would. For some of our young people, it is working their way through college. We have large numbers of our most successful CTE students are the ones who are going to four-year school, but they can work their way through because they have another means of making money. So I agree. It's not one or the other, but yes, one of the major drivers for our analysis that we did in this particular frame on CTE was around earning, but it's not just about earning.
And when it comes to college, I mean, it's the norm now for kids to go through college and take much more than 4 years to matriculate.
Without a doubt.
College president tells me that, you know, that the four-year degree is just a myth.
And I was talking
to one
of
the kids
are
working, and you know,
that's right. And one of your interns, we were talking about Northeastern University in our home state. And one of the reasons why Northeastern University is so attractive is their incredibly extensive and robust co-op program, where young people are actually earning money while they're in school. So I agree that it's not a simplistic, is it $28 an hour? That's not the goal.
Let's go to Otis in Baltimore. Otis, welcome to the show with Dr. Santalisis.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Doing great, thanks.
Awesome. I'm from Baltimore, born and raised. I'm a product of the Baltimore City Public School System. I graduated from City College in 2003.
Wonderful.
I'm a former Baltimore City Public School teacher, and I'm looking to become an administrator next year. But currently, I'm serving as a mayoral fellow in the Mayor's Office of Children and Family Success. And this is a brand new office that hasn't even really went live yet. I think we become official July 1. But my question for you, Dr. Santalisis, is how do you envision the school system and the new Mayor's Office of Children and Family Success being able to collaborate in a lot of different ways? Because some of the things that you're saying are direct initiatives that we're focused on. Basically, how can we improve the outcomes for young people and families in the city of Baltimore? So I'm very excited to hear some of the things that you're saying, because I feel like these real life and practical issues are sometimes left out of the conversation. Like what you guys said, it becomes educationalese, where we are talking about these things that seem so lofty that the average layman can't even understand what we're supposed to be trying to say.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, Otis, thanks for that call. I mean, Mary Young has shaken a bunch of things up, a bunch of agencies. It sounds like a new office. This is a new one to me. Office of Children and Family Success. Do you know about it?
I sure do. And what's really exciting is, you know, in addition to Otis, former colleague in city schools, Tisha Edwards,
She was the interim superintendent
for a while. That's exactly right. And we worked together during my first round in Baltimore City. And no, very excited for a lot of the reason Otis says. I think Mayor Young's long-term commitment to children is a great kind of kinetic force in this, to be able to connect the needs of families with schools and, frankly, a variety of other agencies. I think the bottom line is we as Baltimore City need a strategy that is a whole strategy for young people, not just a school strategy, not just a rec and park strategy, not just a health strategy or anything else. It has to be a citywide strategy. If you look at certain state and cities that have made great inroads in the quality of life and success for their young people, they are cities and states that have taken the kind of approach that I know Otis is going to be working on in his new job. So congratulations on that, Otis. No, and we really are looking forward to it, because the school system alone is not going to solve all of these issues, and we do need to look at it across views.
Let's try to take another call from John in Baltimore. John, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I'd like to make a couple of comments about career and technical education. Colleges, there seems to be this misnomer that career and technical education is prevalent or should be prevalent at the high school level and colleges for other things. Colleges and community colleges especially have been doing career and technical education mm-hmm. for a long, long, long
That's
time.
Right.
I happen to be the director of a career and technical education program at a community college in Maryland. I think that the value of teaching career and technical education at the high school level is not that it's going to create HVAC technicians and electricians and carpenters at the age of 17 and 18. Quite frankly, most of the students exposed to that at the high school level will probably not enter that profession or those professions, at least not right away, but it exposes it to them. And later on, if and when they try other things, they can always come back to that. Another comment I'd like to make, piggybacking on that, is that I think the bigger problem is that, and I hear this from, I'm in the construction industry, I hear it all the time, we can teach anybody how to use a screwdriver, so to speak. What we can't really teach in the field is we can't teach people to not be on their phones. We can't teach people to show up every day. We can't teach people to show up on time. We can't teach people to take direction well. So it's those other kinds of softer skills that I think are going to be more valuable for anybody going into any of those professional occupations.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, mm-hmm. John. I appreciate it.
No, and I think it's both points are well taken. I think with regards to the soft skills, we're seeing that, and employers across industries are saying the same thing, and they're saying that, frankly, about college graduates as well.
Sure.
So it's not just that. We do need to work on that, but we also know, and I think this is an important point, that most young people who are going to make a career in these fields are going to have to be prepared for some post-secondary education.
Sure.
And so that is why the work that we do is really important.
I've had more than one police commissioner tell me that they have to teach police academy students soft skills, like how to talk to somebody
exactly.
instead of texting them. Speaking of construction, by the way, the
sure.
governor has fenced off $127 million for school construction. This is one of several things that are being fenced off now, including mm-hmm. the BSO funding and funding for rape kit testing and all that kind of stuff. What do you know about that? How would that affect the city school systems in terms of your construction and keeping up with some, you know, pretty hefty challenges when it comes to infrastructure?
Yes, and I won't get into the details of, you know, what the governor's doing with fencing off or any of that, but I will say this. Any money that is slated for construction, for upkeep of building inventories of schools is going to negatively impact city schools. When you have the oldest
buildings.
And
how much are we talking about with the city? Because $127 million is for the whole state.
Yes, and I'd have to double check. It might be, I think for us, maybe $30 million or
mm-hmm.
so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reality is there is not enough capital investment being made now to make up the ground for long-term historical underinvestment in buildings. So any delay, any ceasing of any of that funding is just going to continue to perpetuate the same trajectory that has led us to the place where we are now. And even with an outstanding operations team and a new chief, that's not going to make up for lost cash.
I got 30 seconds.
Please.
But there's an emailer wants to know about the so-called grade-changing scandal.
Yes.
This emanates from a report on Fox 45, the Sinclair outlet here in Baltimore, and the governor himself has repeated mm-hmm. the claims made in that report.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly, your assessment.
Sure. Look, we wanted to protect whistleblowers, which is why we didn't release the documents first. As soon as the court said that we needed to, we did. And I will say this, we went all the way back to 2010. We only had 23 investigations that required to be launched based on what we saw. We had like 70,000 documents. And the bottom line is only four of those cases were substantiated. Four cases in 8 years is not widespread grade changing. It just isn't. So with all due respect, I don't know how many news outlets want to fixate on one thing, but four cases in 8 years is not rampant grade changing.
Dr. Sonia Santalisis is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. Good to see you. Thank you so much. And
we'll
check in as always.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Tom.
We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recently recognized by the Daily Meal. You can find their menu and hours at joesquared.com. By the way, the lunch choice today for Baltimore City Elementary Schools, PB&J sandwiches, hummus plate, oven fries, and side salad. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we are live at at the Lewis. We're going to be broadcasting our show from the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African-American History and Culture in downtown Baltimore. We're going to talk about reparations with a terrific panel, Dr. Ray Winbush, Ajoa Ayatoro, and E.R. Shipp. We'll also check in with Jackie Copeland, the director of the Lewis Museum. Come to our website for more information and a link to a free ticket. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.